This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is February 13th, 2020, and this is episode 176. I'm Ian Bushfield.
And I'm Matthew Naylor.
Thanks for joining us.
I'm very pleased to be here.
It's like it's a doubleheader tonight with Cambie Report. People should also go listen to that.
It is. We are two-thirds-ish through our death march of a recording session, and
we're mentally burned out.
Yep.
But let's talk about how protests didn't cancel the throne speech this week. That's basically all that really happened. It was a quiet week.
Yeah.
There were a lot of protests.
There's a lot of stuff on that went down, but Sound and Fury, the signifying nothing part, largely came through the throat speech.
The other thing, we have a lot of our patrons for this show. We have 85 people contributing every month. That's up 3 from last week. Thank you, Trevor, Joe, and Alex, for adding your contributions. That's a total of $260 US per month. Go to patreon.com/politicoast. And as always, Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. And come see Scott, me, and the team behind Pop This at the Fan Expo Podcast Alley on Saturday at 5:15 if you don't already have tickets and are listening to this before that happens. Details will be in the show notes. So, main segment, really what's happening. Idle No More once more. The protests over the Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs being somewhat expelled from their land in the eyes of many for the Coastal GasLink pipeline to go through have erupted across the province, across the country, and are getting noticed. I think the National Post said Canada has gone into chaos and Trudeau must act as they would.
Yeah. Well, the National Post has never overreacted to anything. So we can all be sure that that is a level-headed presentation of what I'm sure is a totally undemocratic expression of nobody's democratic or hereditary or enshrined in law rights.
So following up on last week, I think what I talked about with Scott is that there were reports of media being excluded from the exclusion zone,
as the name would imply,
which is somewhat of an overreach by the RCMP, as there are often contingencies offered. What am I trying to say?
We're a free and democratic society.
Yeah, we have freedom of the press. They should be able to be there to observe state action.
Would not fly under Section 1.
So credit to Canadian Association of Journalists for pushing back, and the RCMP actually, I think, changed course like hours after we recorded and permitted mostly independent journalists who were up there to go and cover the situation. Now, there's still some ongoing reports of people not getting to cover everything they want, and it's always going to be a push and pull. There are certain situations where RCMP may feel there is a justifiable case for safety.
And the RCMP does have an obligation to protect the safety of those who are observing and also not compromise operational integrity. Like, it is
a push and pull.
A free and democratic society, such restrictions on rights may be justified in certain circumstances. We have a balancing act to perform, but that does not involve the balancing by hammering a large steel barrier around it and then sticking a magnet to it, which is effectively what the RCMP were doing on the other side. It's like, yeah, it's standing up. You can see it. It's like, no, we have to be able to get through.
Number of people have been arrested in the exclusion zone, including matriarchs from the Wet'suwet'en Nation. There have been about 28 arrests, I read in one report. Most of those people have been released, but some are facing court dates for breaking an injunction, which is a crime.
It is a crime, and things must be respected. There have been solidarity protests in Vancouver, which we have spoken about somewhat on the Cambie Report, Victoria, Edmonton, and in Ontario. It is loud. It is one of the biggest series of protests that I frankly am surprised about, because it is the largest expression of support for Indigenous title and sovereignty. I mean, there are ways you can come down on both sides, in particular because the elected government of this band has signed an agreement and has been supportive of Coastal Gas
Yeah, I'll put a couple backgrounders in the show notes. The Globe and Mail had a really good long-form piece looking at what exactly is the governance situation. How does the hereditary system work? What is their claim to be the rights and title holder versus the elected band council? The very quick of it is the hereditary chiefs are the traditional governance structure versus the band council was created by the Indian Act to manage the people on the reserves, roughly.
Yes.
And it varies nation to nation what the role between those is. Mm-hmm. In many nations, they've basically merged.
And in many nations, it is a source of ongoing conflict.
Yeah, and often they do get along. For a while, many of the hereditary chiefs were also elected councillors. But what happened more recently is some of the ones who are protesting tried to run again and lost to people who were pro-pipeline.
Yes, which, of course, means that in addition to defending the traditional and ancient rights of the Wet'suwet'en, they are trying to override the democratic will of the Wet'suwet'en. What an interesting challenge.
Well, and it's not always everyone of a nation who gets to vote in tribal council elections, which also makes it more complicated.
Yes. And that, again, varies nation to nation. And I don't know what the Wet'suwet'en voting requirements are. I know my mother can vote in band elections. There is a whole interesting history of like conflict between new and old governance structures. And it is far from over and is basically a decision that every nation is going to have to make for itself via the nation to nation relationship with the crown.
Those protesters have largely decided to side with the hereditary chiefs in this situation. And that's what led to the blockade of the legislature on Tuesday, which we'll get into in a second. The first thing that comes up, though, is this question of, you know, where are British Columbians and Canadians falling on this? And this afternoon, Angus Reid actually dropped a poll on this question, or the results of a poll, saying to British Columbians, do you support these protesters or do you oppose them? And I found it rather surprising that 46% of British Columbians actually support, as opposed to 49% who are opposed. I kind of presumed naively, just my intuition would be that the protesters were not representative of, you know, a majority opinion or even half kind of down the middle. That doesn't mean that they're wrong. It just, I'm used to protesters representing like a third of the public opinion, a loud third.
Yeah. And part of it is that like, reconciliation is a process that, in its painful way, stops and starts, etc., is working.
Angus Reid also asked the very helpful question, how many people think there should be more dialogue with the hereditary chiefs? A lot of people agree with that, surprisingly. Mm-hmm. Not all questions are good questions for pollsters.
Which, of course, we should, of course, direct our questions about the governance of Canada to Lord Beaverbrook and the other hereditary barons of Canada. I mean, like, it is effectively that situation. It's not exactly as entrenched as the British hereditary system, but it is as old and ancient. It is a system of familial power.
Yeah, it's that with an added, the Globe and Mail piece is good on this. It adds in a bit of, it's not automatic that you get the title. You do still have to earn it and show that you are worthy of it. Mm-hmm. You kind of have, like, the opportunity to prove you should be the title holder, which is at least some safeguard. You know, I'm not a personal fan of hereditary titles in most situations because...
Oh, I'm a fan of hereditary titles.
Okay.
But not power.
Fair enough.
I like the Gugas, but not so much the... And now Prince Charles was installed as the... Or invested as the Prince of Wales... And therefore should control Wales.
Like... And I mean, the point of nation to nation, though, is whether I like their system or not doesn't dictate whether it's a valid system. Canada has to respect the system we're dealing with and the people's choice. Now, we mentioned the tension, but that system exists. That is their governance structure in their minds.
It is one of their governance structures.
That's where it gets complicated.
They lost. They, like, lost an election. It's complicated.
Yeah.
And, of course, no group of people has one opinion, CF Vancouver City Council. But, again, check out the Canby Report. What a hilarious time that is. So, like, are the protests effective? We don't know yet, really.
Yeah. I mean, I asked this question kind of broadly because one of the things that always comes up is, oh, people are just protesting and it's not going to change anything. It's not going to affect anything. And I think that's a naive view of history and protest. A lot of protests aren't good at short-term change, but I did try to do a little bit of look at what sociologists, political scientists have studied on this question. And there's some sympathy with the idea, you know, protests, when they're nonviolent, when they meet certain criteria, are often able to bring about change eventually.
Later.
Yeah.
And it, oftentimes, it's like dropping a tea bag into some water. The tea bag itself doesn't instantly make tea. It
has and the water is really angry that a tea bag was just shoved in there.
Yes. Because water has memory, and that's why homeopathy works.
It doesn't.
Just for clarity. onto Ottawa Trek, for example, started in Vancouver and made its way to Regina. It was supposed to go to Ottawa, didn't. But it, in doing so, it managed to seep into the public consciousness of a nation that would, in 3 years' time, turf R.B. Bennett and elect William Lyon Mackenzie King to another term of his eternity running Canada. The same thing, I think, could be argued from Occupy, where a bunch of loud and angry people decided to occupy a bunch of parks. And that catalyst, which happened in 2010, eventually metastasized into a very effective political movement in Bernie Sanders in the United States, and like a kind of more namby-pamby version in Canada that has seen a variety of more left-wing policies get introduced because of it.
So the big move that got a lot of attention this week by the protesters was to try to shut down the legislature on Tuesday prior to the throne speech. They were effective at blocking all the main entrances and getting the legislature to postpone many of the ceremonial and cancel some of the ceremonial displays that happened prior to the throne speech. So the lieutenant governor, I believe, did not inspect the sergeant-at-arms and his team and some of the other...
I mean, they
you like ceremony, I
do. I do like ceremony. I mean, but since they stopped wearing the morning suit, it really doesn't really hold any water for me. Doesn't really do it anymore.
And then through
there's a lovely civic uniform that all the lieutenant governors share between. So the only civic uniform that is like left in Western Canada lives in the Alberta legislature, and the lieutenant governors like borrow it from Saskatchewan and British Columbia when they are doing their state opening of parliament. And it is like very pretty, and it's all like gold braid on the thing. It looks very military, but it's the civilian uniform
right.
for like high civic office. Oh. And it is truly delightful. If you are in Edmonton, go on the really great tour of the Alberta legislature. Check out the rainy spot.
Yeah. See the palm tree.
See the palm trees that were given as a gift for winning a basketball game. And check out the civic uniform. It is quite a tour.
So to get access to the legislature on throne speech day, MLAs kind of got shuttled in two by twos with police escorts as the protesters kind of eventually gave way to letting some of them in. I think some MLAs were a bit more get out of my way and push themselves in, not in a physical assault way, but kind of didn't take as much
guff. Probably didn't meet the de minimis
no.
requirements.
On the other hand, I think other MLAs, and particularly the Green MLAs, Adam Olson and Sonia Furstenow, who Adam Olson had been up to the Wet'suwet'en territories to try to negotiate and speak with or hear from the hereditary chiefs directly, probably felt a lot more conflicted personally about crossing those protest lines, and especially since the protesters were indiscriminately yelling shame at everyone who walked by, including journalists who also were blocked from entering and then later from leaving the legislature to actually cover the protest, which generated a lot of consternation on Twitter from the journalist and pundit class who were like, we just want to cover you. You should respect our press freedom. And I'm like, most of these protesters look like they're kids either from high school or university. They probably don't know who you are, Richard Zussman. I'm like, most people don't. I'm sorry. You may have said I'm press.
Well, that's because they've all stopped wearing fedoras with little press passes in them.
Please bring that back.
Please bring them back. Well, that's all I have to say on that, really. Hats for journalists. Hats for journalists that let them pass protests. That's effectively the thing. Horgan apparently had a little bit of thinking to do because he did delay his media availability for 24 hours after the throne speech to reflect.
Yeah, and then he kind of came forward with, he's in a tough spot, right? Because he has passed and championed the UNDRIP bill and champions reconciliation. But
though
here,
probably didn't exactly think out what doing that would have meant.
And here he's being called a hypocrite for not honoring that commitment by the protesters. And so, and he also comes from the NDP, where there's a history of militancy and labor activism and protests and that kind of thing. So he says, on the one hand, you know, I support their right to protest. This is a free country, yada, yada, yada. On the other hand, maybe they went too far and this was throne speech day and
tried
to have it both ways.
Institutions have to protect themselves, and he is leading one of those institutions. So, yeah, it's of course like the same problem with any kind of movement that wants to see substantial change, is that for some people that change is not going to come fast enough. And this is why revolutions are dangerous, in my opinion, because of course at some point the wave overstrips everyone and devours them.
And the only other element to the protests I'll touch on at the legislature, one that drew a lot of attention, is three Victoria City councillors joined the protest. Ben Isaac, unsurprisingly, Sharmake, I don't actually know how to pronounce his first name, Sharmake, I believe, Dubo, and Jeremy Loveday, three of the most left-wing councillors, unsurprisingly. Isaac was later on Twitter calling out a Victoria Police Department tweet claiming that there had been assaults at the legislature. He called those hashtag hogwash and hashtag fake news.
I mean, there were definitely assaults that happened at the legislature, because the threshold for an assault is any threat. Like, there was definitely tortious assault. Whether there was, like, criminal assault, maybe not. But, like, I don't know. Have a little, like, sense of restraint if you're an elected official. Like, just dial it back and don't trump up every single... I use that in both senses of the word. Like, every single bit of outrage.
Isaac has, like, managed to master the art of being, like, the left-winger who's... Like, you know how so many right-wing politicians are able to own the libs and generate that outrage by everything they say? Is it is that, but for the left?
Mm-hmm. As opposed to the BC Liberals, who, where owning the libs, of course, means simply allegiance to capital. But where the emphasis is on owning rather than anything else.
So, Premier has now announced in a letter today that he and the Federal Indigenous Service Minister are willing to meet and sit down with the hereditary chiefs and try to hash out a deal, provided they ease up on some of the blockades, particularly around the rail lines.
Are they going to include the elected government of the band? Like, this is the question.
They have been consulted, and they agreed to it.
They have been consulted, and they agreed to it, but, like, this is a question of legitimacy, and if the government is going to treat one government as if it is legitimate and the other as if it is occupying a rail line, there should be, as part of the nation-to-nation dialogue, we don't send the High Commissioner to negotiate with, like, Lord Black of Cross Harbor or whatever. If we want to deal with England, we send them to negotiate with Boris Johnson. I'm, of course, speaking a little bit out of my ass because I actually don't know what the arrangements are for this ongoing negotiation, but it is a very tricky situation.
There was one hereditary chief who's not with the main group that are protesting the pipeline who did reach out to his community on kind of both sides of the issue and said, what we really need to do is, and he referred back to the traditions of this community, is have a big, go to the feast hall and have one of the rare all community kind of meetings to sit down and hash this out and bring everyone to the same position. It would be a more public event, which might dissuade some people from coming and speaking out, but might be a way, it looks like it would be a way to get that community more united, which would also then allow the government to be there and come to an all-around. And that seems like the...
Well, that seems like an optimal solution.
Yeah.
Really having divided voices in your interlocutor is the most frustrating thing in the world, because you don't know who you're negotiating with and you don't know what powers they have. And like, you don't want this thing to be the Treaty of New Echota. So you have to look it up. and so you need to make sure that you have some kind of certainty with which you can operate. If this is all based, at least the hereditary chief's argument is rooted in appeal to tradition, if achieving that through an appeal to tradition also manages to come up with a democratic solution, which is the basis for the legitimacy of the other side of the Wet'suwet'en leadership, good.
So let's hope for that. In the meantime, the speech itself did move forward and the business of government is underway. Let's look at the throne speech itself. It was long and at the same time short on news.
Yeah.
I really actually thought there might be more.
It's not a great time for the government to be doing this, especially since there's an election in the fall. Wait, is that true? I'm pretty sure.
I don't know.
I think all signs point to an election in the fall, which means that a budget that comes a little later in the year will be a better time for the government to...
The budget literally drops on Tuesday.
Yeah, a little later in the year. Technically later in the year. But like, it is actually a really nice 1-2 punch of, this is a reminder of all the nice things that we have done. And if they load all those things into the into the throne speech, all the new goodies, then it's going to get wiped away by a news cycle that will focus entirely on the budget.
So the throne speech spent a long time talking about all the things the government has done. There were line after line of in the first 100 days, which was several years ago now.
Yeah.
So no one cares except the MLAs who wanted to pat themselves on the back on the government side. And then a bit more about what happened in the year after that. And then finally we jumped ahead to pretty much all the things that are underway. There was talks of how childcare is going to keep expanding, the government's going to keep working on affordability, blah, blah, blah. I want to talk about my favorite new thing in this, which is that, and no one knows where this came from, this spring, new legislation will give police more tools to block the use of illegal firearms and ban guns from schools, colleges, universities, and hospitals. Matthew, have you noticed the outbreak of armed people walking around our hospitals and how we need to crack down on that?
No, but that's only because I haven't been injuring myself as much as I normally do, and I haven't been spending enough time in hospitals.
I've spent a fair amount of time in the last 6 months in BC Women and Children's Hospital. Mm-hmm. Haven't seen any guns.
No?
No. I don't know.
It's not like the Texas model where they give a gun to every infant?
Sadly not. We don't have enough freedom here. I don't know what's motivating this, because number one, it's already illegal to walk around with a gun unless you have very specific licenses, which generally control also where you can carry it, which is, I'm pretty sure, never a hospital.
Yeah, you basically have to keep it either in your home, at least for handguns, you have to keep it in the home or a locked compartment in the trunk of your car.
Yeah.
It is very onerous to get a handgun, which is exactly how it should be. We should be able to get guns because freedom, but it should be very annoying to do so.
And, like, I get that there are issues to tackle in Surrey and in some areas with gun violence and crime.
But no one purchased those guns through a legal system. Like, it's all illegal handguns that are being smuggled up from the States. Like, it's not... The problem isn't with the legally purchased handguns. It is the illegal ones that are an issue.
And, like, the only reason I think the government has this list, schools, colleges, universities, and hospitals, is I think those are properties they own. So they can say, all right, the federal government is actually in charge of criminal law and can tell you can't have your gun, or you can only have your gun in certain situations, but we can say you can't have guns in the places we own.
Or regulate.
And regulate.
Yeah. So, I mean, to block the use of illegal firearms, which are, of course, illegal already.
They should be doubly illegal, though.
I mean, the phrase that gives me pause is, give the police more tools to block.
Yeah, as a civil libertarian, I'm not generally a fan of that.
Yeah. Don't know what those tools are. And Mike Farnworth has been, frankly, a kind of shitty Solicitor General.
Yeah, I've not been a big fan of some of the bills he's passed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Take all the people's money bill. Not criminals, just people might be criminal.
Yeah.
Take their stuff.
Yeah. Yep. also the let's not follow the recommendations of the provincial health officer decision.
To decriminalize all drugs.
Faux decriminalize all drugs, yeah.
So among other things that was sort of announced, so the BC NDP has talked about action for more affordable cell phone plans. And for a long time, that sounded like it was going to be based on Ontario's clearer billing requirements that cell phone companies couldn't bury fees for you. But in the throne speech, what they have promised to do is to travel to Ottawa to beg the federal government to make our cell phone plans more affordable.
Well, that is a stunningly unimaginative and, frankly, unthing to do.
Yeah, I agree. It's the, like, lowest of bars.
Everyone knows our plans are among the least affordable in the world. Everyone knows this. Yes, we have a large country, and this is not going to solve it.
There are options in the Social Democratic toolkit that they could choose.
There are options in the Conservative toolkit that they could choose.
They could nationalize part of the industry. They could force... They can't... So the province is in the tough situation where they can't control some of the competitive structures. Those are at the federal level. I think that's where they're...
Yeah, no. These are all regulated through CRTC and the Canadian Telecommunications Act.
But they could revive a BC Tel,
as
Manitoba has public option, which seems to keep their cell phones much cheaper.
Yeah. Also, Manitoba is flat.
That does help. But you only need to cover the highways in this province.
That's true.
Alberta, when you look at maps, Alberta actually has the most percentage of its province covered by cell phone signals, mainly because it's one of the few provinces people live in most corners of.
Yeah, that is true. But also, it's flat.
Yeah, for the most part. And one of the other promises in this throne speech was to give 5 days paid leave for those fleeing domestic violence. They've, in the previous parliament, passed a lead bill that if you are someone who flees domestic violence, you can take 5 days unpaid, and now they'll make them paid. Which, if you are in a situation where you need to flee spousal abuse, not worrying about work feels like something the government can do to help.
Yeah.
The response, though, to this from Andrew Wilkinson, who was trying to discuss glibly, I guess, how the...
Glib is perfect. Is a perfect way to describe the Wilkinson tenure.
It's basically, he was trying to say how the NDP is not doing anything, and he lists off a few things, and he says, you know, and they just want to give a few extra days for people, quote, leaving a tough marriage. He walked back later saying it was the wrong choice of words, and he...
No shit, Andy! Like...
I think this tops wacky time of life for renting.
Oh, it does. That was insensitive and out of touch. This is fucking repulsive. And, like, I don't think that I'm going to vote NDP next election, though in a shocking turn of events, I am going to leave that door open a iota, though I am sad, of course, to see Minister Mongeau leave the energy portfolio, greatest minister of energy and mines of our time. The challenge that I have with voting BC Liberal is that I haven't been given a single goddamn reason to do so. My temperament and politics generally aligns.
Yeah, you've worked for them. You've supported the party in
many ways. Given a substantial amount of my blood and tears and time to that party. And it is very disheartening, frankly, to see it devolve into this party of furious grievance and out of touch defense of entrenched private interest. Like, sure, there was always a little of that. Entrenched private interest is, in many ways, what the country was built on, and so must be protected to some extent. But, like, the crap that the Wilkinson Liberals have been playing, like, not moving fast enough on ride-sharing. Who cares? Who cares? It's a government. It takes time. Like, opposing the efforts to fix ICBC, a mess that they created. It is an abysmal record that the Wilkinson Liberals have had, and I have very little time for them at the moment. So
I give them credit. I give them credit for not going reactionary right, like so many right-of-center parties seem to want to do these days. But that's a low bar.
Yeah.
They haven't appealed to deplorable nationalism yet. I don't think Wilkinson will go that way.
No.
Luckily.
No. Nor do I think, at least in the institutional part of the party, there's a lot of support for doing that. But that's because it's just the political wing of the Chamber of Commerce. I mean, just as the NDP is the political wing of the Union Hall. And, like, you know, 'twas ever thus. But, like, the Chamber of Commerce has a policy shop. And, you know, imagine had Andrew Wilkinson decided to take a stand, you know, Dr. Wilkinson had decided to support the Provincial Health Officer's report in the face of Minister Farnworth's refusal to act on it. That would have been a stand for personal and individual liberty and freedom that I would have wholeheartedly supported. They have elected to not.
Wilkinson was a past president of the BC Civil Liberties Association. But politics changes everyone. Let's move on to a bit of a roundup of where the leadership races are at. There's no news out of the BC Greens that I'm aware of. We'll dispense with that. Sonia Furstenau is still the only candidate there. The only news out of the federal Conservative race this week was a bunch of headlines and articles about how John Baird might enter the race, how he needs to enter the race, how he's the only hope for the race, till today he tweets out that he is not entering the race, which is pretty much what I'm thinking he had said a couple months ago, or at least he wasn't planning on it. Until this last week when people begged him to run, and then he didn't. So it's not even really news.
So who is in the race? It's Aaron O'Toole and Peter McKay right now are the two
front runners. Marilyn Gladue is also a former current MP. There's a couple, one or two other no-name MPs who are pretty new, and then some other people no one has heard of, like Aaron Seal, the millennial conservative, who is ridiculous and probably not going to be able to afford to get in.
So, but like the two big names that have dropped out so far, Baird and Polyevra, are like those are. Polyevra more so than Baird is a shocking retreat from what I had assumed was going to actually be a fairly substantive candidacy from him.
And instead, we have Peter McKay fumbling all over the place.
But pride parades are important. Like it's. J.J. McCullough has an interesting piece, and I often disagree with J.J., but the McKay candidacy is the reductio ad absurdum of a group of people who want to make the Conservative Party less conservative. And while I am all for a reimagining of conservatism, Andrew Wilkinson, just being stupid about it and reactionary, and not even like actually reactionary, just sort of like that kind of knee-jerk reactionary reflex to say, oh, David Eby has done something dumb and I must react, is really, really stupid. I've dragged this back to Wilkinson, but I am so incensed. But that's because the Conservative...
McKay's not presenting anything.
Yeah.
Aaron O'Toole at least has a vision, but it doesn't fit with who he is, or at least was in the last leadership race, because now he's trying to be truer blue than blue.
Yeah.
Which...
I mean, it does expose Aaron O'Toole as a completely... principleless goon.
And maybe that's what the Conservatives need.
I mean, it worked for them for 9 years.
Well, let's move over to the federal Green leadership race. I missed last week that they'd released their rules. It turns out their rules are actually pretty controversial in the Green Party, which is amazing. So as a reminder, to run for the federal Conservatives, you need to have $300,000, which they raised from the previous race, and get, I believe it was 1,000 signatures from members in multiple different ridings. You can't just get them all in Calgary. The Greens, by comparison, are requiring $50,000 entry fee.
Which is, I think, the same as the federal Liberals, but...
Yeah, I saw a comparison. The Liberal Party in 2013 was $75,000. The NDP's last one was $30,000.
So the Greens are trying to behave like an actual party.
But this has led... And then the other half of it is you'll have to get 100 nominations from party members, including 20 young Greens... for the initial application, and then by September 1st, you'll need to get an additional 150 nominations, including 20 members in 5 of the 6 regions that they've defined, so you show some national support. Those are not significant numbers, and if you can't get that many signatures, you don't deserve to be a federal party leader. And the same kind of applies for the money, because you don't write a check, you get people to support you, and you give their money to the party.
Yes.
And if you can't get their money,
You don't deserve to run.
Nevertheless, Alex Terrell, who's the, I believe, leader of the Quebec Greens, who's possibly the most talked about candidate running because he wants to run on the eco-socialist left side of the party.
The anti-Weaver, basically.
Yeah. He claims, they say they're putting the party for sale. It looks like they're looking for candidates who hang out in country clubs.
I mean, they're going to need some candidates who hang out in country clubs. That's where the money is. But like, seriously, if you can't raise $50,000, you shouldn't be a federal party leader. It is very simple. Like, it's not a high bar. Yes, it will be a challenge. But also, if the Green Party wants to be an electoral success, it costs $50,000 at minimum to run a riding campaign.
Two other candidates have looked at these rules and decided that they're not for them. Possibly Konstantin Kritsonis, who's run for the Greens in 7 elections, immediately withdrew his name. And Quebec lawyer Dimitri Lascaris looked at another element, which is that there is going to be a vetting process before you're allowed to run, and he called that preposterous.
Well, I'm sure Hector Brenner can sympathize.
Fair enough. First, the throwback to Vancouver politics. Yeah, the Green Party rules are frankly reasonable, in my opinion. Nevertheless, the Greens are still struggling to attract talent.
A reasonable set of rules for an unreasonable party.
They have 3 elected members right now.
Plus, almost rule Prince Edward Island. Like,
well, none of those people are going to want to leave their cushy MLA positions in the PEI legislature for a less influential national party where they wouldn't even have a seat.
No. And in fact, they probably wouldn't have to.
Yeah.
But, you know, as May turns to June and the Green Party enters the summer of its discontent, we must eventually, as always, bid you adieu.
Well, let's close with our quick takes. Just a few stories this week. First up, Trudeau is still pursuing a UN Security Council seat, and this week he has secured the crucial vote from Senegal.
This is important because we are fighting Ireland and Norway, which are expected to take a lot of the European seats that Canada would normally have gotten support from. And so we are cozying up to a bunch of people in Africa and Southeast Asia, where it is expected there are votes up to grab.
What's your take on going for a Security Council seat? Is this valuable for Canada?
I think that having chosen to go for it at a time when Ireland and Norway had already announced was probably a little hubristic, but it is...
But Canada is back.
It is back. Why is it back? Trudeau has yet to articulate a clear and strident foreign policy that would, in fact, lend any credence to it. It is honestly something that I would really rather have if Chrystia Freeland was prime minister.
Fair enough. Well, speaking of his foreign policy, the one thing we haven't made a decision on yet is whether to let our 5G networks be built by Chinese arm of the Chinese government, almost Huawei.
It's a prosthetic arm, but it's the most advanced in the world.
The news this week is Canada's military is reluctant to support this and would actually prefer if Trudeau did ban Huawei. It seems likely we're going to do this because the U.S. has done it and through the Five Eyes connections doesn't want any other countries it's connected to put what could theoretically be a security hole to the Chinese government into our telecom backbone.
Oh my God. Canada is like nothing but security holes, though. Our... Like, our industrial espionage sector is a growth industry. It is abysmal. We have so many of our inventions stolen and repurposed and commercialized by other nations and bad actors. And frankly, limiting innovation and our access to the most advanced technology isn't necessarily the best route, but I think that the problem is way more structural and systemic than one simple ban is going to achieve. So maybe fix the underlying problem and we wouldn't have the stupid international trade and relations detonating issue on the table.
Well, the last thing I want to touch on is we haven't actually talked about coronavirus on this podcast at all, despite its touching Canadian soil with a growing number, but still number of cases you can count on one hand, at least here in BC. But there's an interesting story, or actually kind of a tragic story right now, where this cruise ship, the MS Westerdam, is going around the South Asian Sea trying to find somewhere to dock.
Sorry, South China Sea.
South China Sea.
Let's not piss off China anymore.
Sorry. It's going around the South China Sea trying to find somewhere to dock. It's gone to Thailand, Japan, Taiwan, Guam, and now the Philippines, and each of them has barred it from docking out of fears that...
Guam?
Apparently.
Guam?
It's on the list.
I mean, Guam is America, but sure.
There's a fear that if people walk off this ship, they'll infect the country and pandemic. Global Affairs Canada has confirmed 279 Canadians are aboard this cruise ship. I don't know what you do. There's 1,455 passengers on this ship and another 802 crew members.
This is a Holland America line?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. I have been trying to figure out whether we are overreacting, underreacting, or reacting just the right amount. I think face mask sales are, one, an overreaction.
Agreed.
I think that China quarantining 35 million people was actually probably justified, at least in terms of China not being a place where you have rights. But whenever a pathogen is able to jump species, as basically all pathogens are, they always seem to come from fucking bats, but a lot of things come from bats. The race is between, one, the pathogen's ability to spread and its virulence and mortality. And from all indications right now, the death rate of COVID-16, I think it's called, is around 3%, which would be fucking catastrophic in a global pandemic sense. The other side of this is epidemiologists and immunologists trying to fight a virus that they are just encountering, trying to figure out a vaccine and other ways of containing it so that it doesn't become this global pandemic. Now, one, that death rate might be higher because a lot of people could have thought, oh, I've got the flu, I'm just going to stay home, and then they recovered or died.
And never were reported.
Yeah. So that is a hopeful sign, but it also could mean that we have a very dangerous disease on our hands, and keeping it from spreading is the thing that buys us time. And it is just a desire to buy time at the moment. So I think that a sense of cautious attention is probably the way that we should be approaching the coronavirus. Don't light your hair on fire, but also be mindful if you get a cold, and just maybe go into your doctor and get it checked out.
Yeah, I think there's not been a significant number of cases reported in our area here in Vancouver. The cases that have very clear connections to areas where this virus is prominent in China and elsewhere. And so, you know, I have a medically fragile child, and so I'm very worried about infection. But what we're worried about is the common cold, the flu. RSV is a special virus that babies apparently get quite frequently, but is very dangerous for some babies. And so we have special shots for that. Those are the things I'm looking out for. Like you said, the masks generally don't do anything. They're kind of okay if you are sick.
Yeah.
That's where the one exception is. Don't just wear them all the time. That's just wasting materials.
Yeah.
I think there has been fear spread to the point where I've seen headlines. I don't know how accurate they are that there's not been... or there's been dramatic drops in sales in several malls around Metro Vancouver because people are afraid to go out in public. I mean, I've been to Metro Town and it still feels busy, but...
It always feels busy,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, it always feels busy.
I don't know exactly what is going on in the mall architecture there, but it always feels busy. It always stresses me out.
And they're still tearing it down eventually in the next little while.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the BC Center for Disease Control is doing its best. It's got a wealth of information on its website that is evidence-based and that is clear, in my opinion. And I, you know, it feels like they're doing the right things, and we are slowly learning as a globe how to treat and how to, you know, respond to these kind of epidemics.
Yeah. We shouldn't light our hairs on fire. We should simply listen to our provincial health officials, Mike Farnworth And with that,
that's been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show, get access to the exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. The intro music you hear is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikov. I still get people asking, even though we say that every time. Politicoast is a production of Leg and Boot Media. Editing services are provided by Cortado Productions. Thanks for listening. Scott will be back next week.